Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is John Johnson on Radio Edutalk. I'm sitting, as usual, in Glasgow, Scotland. And tonight, very pleased indeed to have Leon Syke as our guest. I've got the name right, Leon, the second name.
Sish. But it's open to debate, my second name.
Yeah. So, I mean, as long as I've had any knowledge or awareness of educational technology and the like, you have been a very familiar face and putting up an awful lot of great stuff for, I say, I feel as if I'm getting old now, so it must be quite a long time. Do you want to just start off by giving a bit of background, where you came from, etc., to where you got now, Leon?
Yeah, I went into teaching after sort of doing lots of different jobs, and I worked in inner city schools in London for about 23 years. And in fact, I got onto the internet. In fact, Lisa Jardine, who died recently, got me onto the internet because I was teaching one of her sons. And I said to her, you know, I'd really like to get these kids onto the internet, onto the internet as it was almost pre-World Wide Web. And I said, I just need a modem and I can't afford a modem. So she bought a modem for the class.
Brilliant.
And we got on, and she was amazed that her son had written a web page in about three in one night. In fact, I just gave him a book. I said, go and read this book. And he came back the next day. Puts a lie to all those things that kids can't learn for themselves. Came back the next day, had written a whole half a website, you know, several web pages. And I started going on, and I started writing web pages, and started actually doing podcasts from the get-go. This is the mid-90s, 94 onwards. First thing I did was the school I was working in, which was All Souls School, was right next to the British Museum. So I decided to go to the British Museum and see what resources there were for the ancient Greeks, because I was teaching about the ancient Greeks at the time. And I went through the museum, and there were no resources. There were about a Kodachrome slide. You know, that was it in those days. It was like the dark ages of museum resources. And from what I'd seen on kids, they really just swarmed through museums. They never seemed to have any focus. I thought, wouldn't it be great if I captured all these exhibits in photos and made them interactive with questions? So what I did was I took a camera, a really good camera down there, a film camera, and bought some special slides and slow film, for fast film, I suppose, a tripod. The British Museum gave me the permissions. I went round, photographed all the exhibits in the ancient Greek room, put them all onto CD, because you could just do that in those days. It was beginning to happen. So it was film slide, film to CD, and then took the JPEGs off the CD, put them on a website, which was held initially in Chicago, because there wasn't any that much web space in this country. And then started to read up on the ancient Greeks and try and sort of boil down the core information and put it on the web in terms of interactivity. So we had about 20 rooms and a map through 20 rooms. And in those days, it was getting about 3 hits in this country and about 500,000 on the west coast of the States.
Well, yeah,
because they were all wired up, yeah, and no one was in this country. So I realized the power of putting up resources onto the internet through that. And gradually, sort of an opportunity came up to work for a big media firm in Soho, because the school I taught at was near Soho. And I created classical music resources and Shakespearean resources for this media company who made films of Shakespeare and who had a lot of a big classical music catalog. And this was the early noughties, so I sort of leapt sideways, and I'd sort of built up a number of skills to do with media and video and encoding and just learning how the things worked, because it was the early days, because nothing was formalized. The information was out there in books, it was out there on the web and peer-to-peer. That's how I picked it up. But this was all pre-YouTube, which is where I do most of my learning these days. And the rest is sort of history. I went out and decided to do lots and lots of podcasts with people in the education innovation sphere. And from there, I started filming Teach Meets. And I went and filmed hundreds of Teach Meets, which I've got in a big archive, still on tape. Unfortunately, that was all lost from the web because Disney took over the platform I was putting up the films on and decided to wipe them when I was caring for my father in the last couple of years. But I've still got it all on tape. But I'm not going to transfer it. So now I've got my own white label video sort of archive, which I pay for and archive too on a regular basis. So everything I do goes up to YouTube, it goes up to Vimeo, and it goes up to this separate archive and Dropbox. So I have about four or five places, plus archive.org, where I keep everything. And now I'm concentrating on pushing out media, especially films, because 2 years ago I set up a teacher-to-teacher broadcast channel and made the mistake of thinking teachers would have enough time to make their own media. And I did get a few films in from people, but they weren't that high quality. And I had to sort of scout around and pull together various bits and pieces. So now my main thing is to go out there and film people at source and stick it up. And I had to stop because my father had an accident, and unfortunately last year he died. He was in his 90s, and I was caring for him for 2 years. So I'm back on the scene now and actually producing more media than ever. It's just that it's not formalized. I'm building studios and I'm pushing out week on week, especially film.
Brilliant. And just if anybody's listening in, if you've got a question for Leon on any of this stuff, if you drop a tweet on Twitter and use the hashtag edutalk, or aim your tweet at myself at John Johnson, or Leon at iBeams, which is a lovely Twitter handle, Leon, and I just wonder where that came from.
Well, funnily enough, it comes from everyone thinks it's from the X-Men, but it isn't. It's from a John Donne poem. So if you look up the John Donne poem, look up the word EYEBEAMS, and it's just from a John Donne poem, really, in that sense. I just thought it was quite amusing to take that one word that goes right the way back
and bring it into the last and this century. And what's interesting to me listening to you talking is obviously you started this really very early and almost we're still doing the same thing. It hasn't changed that much, maybe. I mean, I know the techniques and the hardware and stuff like that have changed, but the idea of sharing things online maybe hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, possibly. I think what's changed, and this is what's opened my eyes in the last 18 months, because when I was caring for my father, I didn't have much time to put stuff out, but I did have a lot of time to browse and see what was happening in terms of media. And it's become easier with things like a Periscope on a phone to be able to live stream. Another thing I do is live stream a lot. That's the thing that pays for my philanthropic activities. So usually companies pay me to live stream events or to film and post-produce events. But it's becoming easier and easier to do that with a phone, setting it up, buying a cheap mic, just turning up with a tripod that you can attach the phone to, or even just propping it up against something, pressing a button, and you can record an event or live stream an event. Same with MixLR, I think it's another one, that, or several podcasting apps that go straight out to the web. And you link that up with Twitter, and you've got an instant podcast or video cast facility.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen you and other people's Periscopes, and what surprised me is how good the sound quality is, even from people just using their phones. They seem to be working hard, I presume, at the Periscope end to make make it sound good.
Yes. The rise in tech. This is the other thing I noticed. I came across the Mojo group of journalists. So that's hashtag MOJO, and that stands for mobile journalism. And these journalists have boiled down the ability to go and find a story or sort of appear at a geographically at a place where there is a story to be told, and with their phone and with the minimum of kit, be able to interview someone, take pictures, take some video, take some B-roll, which is video that's sort of dropped into the line when you're doing the interview, and then edit it and send it back to the mainstream media place all in the same day. Mm. And that before required an outside broadcast truck. Now it's someone with a backpack, if that, with a sort of small mic, a really lightweight tripod, and a modem or a MiFi, and they have a special piece of software which sort of re-encodes the film, that puts it in the right sort of coding so that it can be shown on broadcast TV, especially the Radio Television Irish journalists and a number of people who are working for sort of internet media as well, who do this, and it's extremely effective and extremely quick. So you get the ability to be able to push out news and information almost instantaneously. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But there's access, and it levels the playing field, because before, who had, you know, $500,000 for an outside broadcast truck? But you may have a few hundred pounds for a good smartphone and a couple of mics and a tripod and something to hold the phone, and you're away.
Yeah, I was walking through, bizarrely enough, the train station a couple of days ago in Edinburgh, and there must have been something on, somebody famous arriving, and there was a large camera and a giant tripod, and then a series of, it almost was descending in size, where you went through smaller, what I would think of as a video camera, to somebody with an iPad and a tripod, and then at the end of the line, somebody with a phone on the tripod, and a completely different scene than we've seen even a few years ago.
And the point is that it now is almost at the point where you can just pick your phone up and turn it on, and so long as you've got a good content is still king. So long as you've got a good story to tell, and what interests me are grassroots stories from people who are practitioners working in areas that require innovation. They're on the edge of things. They're working on the edge of, on the periphery, let's put it that way. And they're always on the periphery. And it's always interesting to find that these people or communities that are actually working in education and highlight and disseminate what they're doing. It's not always that. Other times it's teach meets and larger scale teach meets where it's important to have the sort of grassroots media pushing out or giving an alternative view to mainstream media as well. I'll often hunt out things that may be topical. I'm doing more and more of this and finding the other side. There's a someone called Documentally, Christian, who went out and went to the jungle in Calais with the refugees and did a sort of 6-hour report on what was happening there. And it was interesting to see, because you don't see these things on mainstream TV. You get little sort of bites that happen, but someone like that who can just pack his stuff into his backpack, go along there and sort of just show the sort of makeshift school that they've got there, the library that they're building, the hospital they're building, and just give you another side to the story, which is coming from the sort of bottom up as opposed to top down and disseminated. It's always interesting, and I think there's going to be more of that in general going to happen in the future. I don't think teachers can do it because they haven't got the time.
Well, I suppose I don't know, I'm still kind of open-minded to that. I mean, EduTalk, the thing we're doing now, we started that as just a contribute by anybody over mobile phones sort of podcast, and when we ran the first thing, we ran it very like you're speaking. We wanted to get voices from the floor, from the Scottish Learning Festival, as a sort of contrast to the big organisations and things that were there, and it worked very well for that year. But I don't know how you maintain it to get.
It's the scalability, isn't it? And it's the ability to be able. So I think you need two things. You need to be able to have what you do in infrastructure and a social media infrastructure really well tightly controlled through hashtags and RSS feeds and other sort of things that push out. So it's visible. And it's visible to a niche audience who, if they so wish, will find themselves in the stream of that media. But I also think, increasingly with film, that sometimes there's a need for good quality film as well. That's what I'm working on at the moment. I'm actually delving deeper into how films are made, not only the story side, but also the technical side as well. Because I think there's a spectrum. You can have a beautiful film that's beautifully made, that's completely vacuous, obviously. And you can have a really rubbish quality, apart from the sound, which has always got to be good, piece or story, which will go viral in that sense. So there's a sort of happy medium between that spectrum. But I'm pushing on all sides. And I'm fascinated by the live stream aspect, because I've noticed that politicians tend to veer away. They used to sort of go towards it, but they tend to veer away from live stream just in case anything goes wrong, or they're caught off the cuff, or someone may say something that's off color. And I'm always fascinated by live streaming something because it has a continuum from beginning, middle, and end. There's no cuts, there's no edits, so you actually see things. You see them through a sort of medium. Again, it's mediated, either through a sort of microphone or a screen, but it's in real time. So you get more authenticity with live streaming in some aspects, in some cases, and that fascinates me too. Plus the access factor, that if people cannot get to an event, then if you can live stream it at that point in time, they can actually just switch on a device, whether it be a phone or a screen or a speaker, put some headphones in, and they've got a whole sort of world there which they don't have to travel, and they can just sort of sit back and reflect.
And I think dipping in and out as well, I mean, it's quite a commitment to go to, say, a conference or even a teach meet, but I'll quite often turn on something like that and watch or listen for 20 minutes and then just drop out again, and that's, you know, I haven't had to travel, but I've got something to think about now, and it can fit in very well with other things. So I think that's
yeah, and that's the nature of the web as well. It's the nature of social media. It's not linear. It's not something like TV programs, like programming. You can have the same thing at the same time every week. But now people tend to coalesce around hashtags. They can tend to coalesce around events. This is on the web, obviously. It's on demand. It's no longer something that is there and fixed. Now, live stream is one of those things that is still, you have to turn up and see it. And it creates a lot of information and a lot of attention while it's happening, and maybe for a day or two afterwards, and then it dissipates again. And that's basically the nature of the web. It's the nature of social media. It's unless someone archives these things, it's there and it's gone. And it's a bit like, you know, having your name writ in water, which I quite like in that sense, you know?
It just dries up or drains into the sand.
That's
very,
right.
Very, very quickly. Yeah, and one of the things I've noticed you do, and it's a sort of thing I've done myself, is that at a conference or something, you'll get somebody in and take them out and get a 5-minute interview for them. And I find that a very useful thing because, you know, I'm maybe listening to an hour-long presentation or a keynote is not as useful or powerful to me as maybe just picking up something that you just interviewed somebody for 5 minutes and get the gist of what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think it's the sort of audio-visual equivalent of TLDR, you know, too long, didn't read. So if someone likes the interview, they'll go back, hopefully, and see the archive of the live stream or watch the live stream at another date. Unfortunately, a lot of organizations tend to live stream out, but it's never archived for some reason, or it's lost, or it's put on the shelf and then forgotten about because people move on because of the nature of things. that chain of being able to link in media as a sort of reference point is also something I'd like to see happen more. But that requires a lot of effort in terms of infrastructure. I think you're very good at that. You're very good at sort of making sure people find the stuff through the way you put it out, I think. Need to pick your brains at some point.
I think it's just blogging, actually. You just keep on stuffing up there and hope somebody sort of listens to it and it's tied together by RSS. You said something in there which I maybe didn't quite get. It was the idea of linking between things. And do you mean by that, one of the differences between video and audio and the written web, or you know, the web is hyperlinks and things like that. And were you hinting at some sort of connection between, and it's the idea of watching something small and then going to the reference?
Yes, I mean, that to be able to put metadata in media is really in its early days still. You know, you can do it on YouTube and things, but to be able to sort of then link that to something like an RSS feed where you could actually pull out the plums. Mm. I mean, the BBC have been able to do it for years, but they do it internally for their journalists in terms of pulling up, let's say, their sort of 25 broadcasts that refer to specifically to penguins, let's say, or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've got an ability to be able to keyword or pull out things like that. I mean, but to be able to do that seamlessly as you go along, and the ability to be able to take to turn things into transcripts, that is the time consuming thing. Those are the things that last. It's still text that sort of anchors any reference or, you know, reference material. You will find it through text mainly. That's how we do things. It's probably best basic way to do that, but to be able to sort of ride on those electronic pathways that aggregate that, that's the key, I think, in the future, should you so wish to do that.
Yeah,
because of the volume of stuff, because with anyone who wants to sort of attempt to make a media platform on a regular basis, like for instance, I'm trying to do a film a week, but I'm also trying to get the colors, the lighting, the audio, the film, everything else as perfect as I can, or as good as, let's say, a mainstream media company, or just getting to the point there that it's passable. And then on top of that, having to then archive and link to and make sure you've got all those reference points is a big ask in that sense.
It's huge. And I noticed one of the things on your site at the moment, you're looking for volunteers to transcribe video and I guess audio. And I remember looking into the cost of this, because after talking to some accessibility people, I got a bit worried about having podcasts without the text, and it was just prohibitive for ourselves, you know.
Yeah, it is. It's. I mean, as I said, I went to the Research Ed conference and I did about 10 interviews, each of about half an hour, and that's £300 to £400 to pay for that particular series of interviews. Of course, once you've got the interviews and they are transcribed, then you can put them on YouTube and you can link those transcriptions to the sort of subtitles that come up, and then you can actually anchor hyperlinks and metadata to that as well. So it is expensive, but if you do it well, with stuff that you really want to keep there and have found for, let's say, you know, years as opposed to minutes or hours or weeks, then that's the only way I can see going forward. The rest, it's just sort of a brief cloud passing in the whole sort of panoply of the things on the web, and that's the way things are. How you actually, if you really are serious about archiving and putting things that would add to the debate or show the times as they are now in terms of historical context, and that's important, I think, to have that rather than the big media companies sort of doing the sort of, like they do for obits, you know, obituaries and things like that. If you have a number of sort of alternative sources, you know, like the Opies with their fairy tales and classroom chants and things like that, looking at that whole alternate history of children's storytelling and games, that's fascinating, because it's a rootsy, it's a grassroots archive of how people did things in those times, which I think people do find fascinating the further you get from the event. So not only have you got the immediacy of the event and the sort of information around it, but let's say 5, 10, 30 years from now, you get this sort of background radiation that permeates
beyond that. And I just wonder if Google will eventually get good enough to transcribe everything, as their crawlers crawl over a podcast site, will they eventually transcribe them all?
Well, there are lampposts now, aren't there, with the microphones in up and down the country, as well as video cameras, so CCTV with audio in as well. it's like the Lewis Carroll story. I think is it Sylvie and Bruno where they talk about the farmers who had a one to one map, but of course they could never use it because they couldn't open it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel it's rather like that with data, really.
Yeah, I guess. But it would be nice if you could call up something like that at a reasonable price, and machine translation or machine transcription got to the state that you could do.
That would be useful, because then you can actually track and see and reference things that people have done, or instances or exemplars of what people do. Because that's what I find amazing, because I go to a lot of different places, film a lot of people, get a lot of opinions. And for my professional development, that's quite amazing. I get a rounded view of what's happening. I don't just go to the things I want to go to. I go to things that I force myself to go into areas that I'm not particularly comfortable with sometimes, and actually get involved in that, or things that I know nothing about. The film I made with Ian Rawes, who the London Sound Survey, I didn't know there was a whole sort of group of people, I have done in the last 6 months to a year, who are absolutely into sound, recording sound and archiving sound and pinning it down and actually changing that sound, or sound artists, people who go to Iceland for a week and record the sounds of geysers and things like this. Fascinating other world.
I remember going I think it probably spun off that London Sound Survey, the UK sound map, and there was an event in Glasgow that I went along to, and somebody was playing the recording of barnacles moving.
Yes.
And the kit these guys had must have been immense. And I don't know if you want to talk a wee bit about hardware, because recently I've been paying attention to what you've been putting out about recommendations for hardware, and you obviously are very keen to get a very good sound, so you're probably going to be disappointed tonight when I finish with this. But I wonder, because just by the by, a friend of mine who is an American educator, I was looking on their blog recently, a post, and I happened to scroll down, and there they'd taken up the advice from your broadcast, and I was quite interested how that spread. But I just wonder if you want to have a sort of, maybe not in depth as you usually go, but just to sort of talk around kit and what would be good for folk who are interested in doing this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean the main thing is to just get something that near to where someone's speaking. So if you've got a mobile phone, put it next to their mouth. If you're recording some audio, proximity is the most important thing. You get the best sound from proximity, so that's your most basic thing. And then, you know, if you want something cheap, buy something by Rode. It's called a Smart Lav Plus, and that will go straight into your phone. You may need an adapter to go into different phones, and that's about £50. It's a big outlay, but it gives you so much better audio in that sense. And you can do voiceovers with it. You can make your own podcast. But having said that, you could just hold the phone or put the phone on a bracket and hold it close to your mouth if you're going to do that sort of thing. It's become so much easier. If you're making film, then obviously you do need to have a mic that will attach to you and you can film at the same time, or you have a mic pointing towards someone. There are lots and lots of options out there. If you just go to my site, which is l4l.co.uk, and put in the word sound as a keyword, it'll probably bring up a few blogs about what you need. And just people need to go out there if they want to make podcasts and make them. The only way you can learn, and the same with film, is to do it. It's one of those things you only learn by doing. You can read all about it, but you only get to really understand how you make the mistakes by actually going and failing several times, which I have done, even up to the present day.
That's always good to know. Quite like that. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm attracted to audio as opposed to video, is that it's easier. To many, you know, you've got less things to think about, almost
less things to go wrong.
Yeah, and again, I as a classroom tool, I think there's quite a lot of people doing various video things now, and maybe not enough doing audio in the classroom, because I think it's probably easier to make something that is at least emotionally appealing with audio as prepared to video.
Yeah, I mean one of the things I advise people to buy is a Zoom H1 recorder, which is wonderful because you can plug one of those mics I talked about previously, the Rode, into that. But it's also got two mics on the top, and it's powered by a 1AA battery, and you put a little mini SD card in there, and you can wander around with it, and you get it right next to people talking, or give it to pupils. And they can make their own podcast. This is the thing where people fail to realize. A lot of language teachers use that kind of... language teachers in particular, I think, in many ways, are very good at using specific forensic ways of media. Because, obviously, it's all about speaking and listening, and as well as all the grammar and the other theory. When you want to actually put things out, children can actually, or pupils or older pupils can construct within a very forensic framework good resources. Those exemplars are out there, but people, you know, tend to naysay them often, or blanketly dismiss technology when it's sort of talked about in a very nebulous way, when it's used in a very forensic, directed, focused way. And so there's some good exemplars out there that work. Unfortunately, it moves so fast that I think a lot of researchers aren't able to pin it down.
There's a sort of classroom use of this. I personally have found it useful, and it's not for the resource the children are constructing, it's the whole business of the stuff that goes around that. You know, the talking and listening that goes on while they discuss what they're going to do, and they prepare, and the writing they've got to do.
A lot of people would dismiss group work, for example. There's a lot of research to say that someone does all the heavy carrying and all that. But if you're making a film or you're making a podcast, and each person has a specific role, and they have to negotiate and talk and reflect on and write. And if that's properly sort of directed, with the teacher acting as an animateur, it can be very, very focused. For example, I've been into schools with primary schools with a small video camera, and got them to discuss Shakespearean characters, and actually go round and elicit people's views on who the characters are, what they do, what the plot is, what they do within the actual thing. It's captured on film, and then get people to act out specific parts within that framework in a very, very focused way, and then come back and use the resource that they filmed to reflect on and further write about things, you know. But you don't hear about this stuff so much, you know. You don't see that in research. It doesn't seem to sort of emerge. And am I thinking, is it only me that can sort of see the sort of affordances of certain technologies within those very, you know, they could be very traditional ways of teaching, but if you, you know, if you just put in at the right intervention, the right resource, in a forensic way, you know, it makes all the difference. Maybe it's just me, but I don't see enough of that being shared or put out. But I could be shot down now if people listen to this.
Well, I suppose the thing that I've always thought that makes these sorts of things is the sharing. And I think quite often when you go into schools, you'll find people are actually making stuff, but they're not publishing it. And I always thought the publishing was a very useful,
yes.
You know, just the fact that you are publishing something as a pupil is exciting in itself.
Yeah. Well, number one, you have to have the confidence to go and do it. Yeah. You have to have the sheer sort of you know, brass to go out there and say, I am going to try this in my classroom. The second thing, you've got to be able to have the technical nous to be able to sort of keep failing until you find that you've succeeded, or not, as the case may be, or find something that does succeed, or just, you know, reject it. And number three, you've got to disseminate it and put a breadcrumb trail down so that people can actually find it. So you've got someone like recently Dan Willingham, who's talking about in the States, who's the great, you know, new guru for lots of people, saying, you know, well, here's, this is educational technology, we don't have much evidence about what's out there, apart from, let's say, the sort of interactive whiteboard stuff that was there a few years back. Now, I mean, yeah, great, but, you know, this is the problem with research, because and then he's himself said that it's not something that you know, you can know about currently, because the researchers haven't got onto it yet. And to be quite honest, they're not looking, because it's traveling too fast. And he himself said, you know, look to the practitioners and the best practitioners doing it, which brings me back to the point that's 10 years ago I started filming teach meets and filming people to try and gather exemplars to do with this. But to get to that sort of level of granularity of what people are doing within their classrooms, within a specific context, within, let's say, a curricular area, that is very hard to do. There are too many parameters. You can't do traditional research around that. I really don't think you can. It's context driven, and it's to do with community, and it's to do with the actual way your school community is run, the sort of way curriculum is introduced, the resourcing, the charisma of individual teachers, possibly. It's going to be, it's extremely elastic, and to be able to aggregate something like that, I don't think you can, really.
So that really sounds like a problem with of too many variables, I guess, that you need to see things in this context.
Yeah, unless you're a sort of person who likes things regimented and you want things done in a certain way at the same time, or you'd like a kind of, you know, one-size-fits-all curriculum with the way it's taught. And you know, I mean, the content, I don't really care what's in curricular content. You know, people can fight over the head of a pin for, you know, eons, as far as I'm concerned. but it's how you actually take that. And as a teacher, you've got so many strings to your bow. Terrible, you know, cliche metaphor. But the point is that if you are open to different ways of teaching, and you are, if you can see exemplars, or you can see opportunities to do that, it's not good enough to have something like a broad brush thing that everyone says technology will do this, technology will do that. You really do have to have specific exemplars, and people will say, yeah, I could implement that, or no, I don't want to do that, it's too labor intensive, or yes, we could adopt that or adapt it, or I don't even go near it, what I'm doing is faster and easier. I mean, I don't care, but people have got to be open to a whole panoply of strategies to get things across. And to say that just one way is always the way, just worries me slightly. So I like to go out there and find things and people who are doing things slightly differently, and get people to reflect on that.
Yeah, that sounds like a great aim, and I think it hopefully should feed in very nicely if we can get over the hump of looking at things in too fixed a frame. Is maybe the thing, and I don't know if what the way you're talking about education is that almost the opposite of the testing regime that's going on here and there.
Well, the irony is that a lot of people who are very pro-test, I mean, it's what happens after the test that's important, really, isn't it? I mean, I don't really care about sort of low-level testing. I mean, one of the things I did a couple of years back, I was as part of my STEM ambassadorship, I went in and taught 2 year 5 classes in a primary school coding for 2 terms for free, 0.2 of the curriculum for free. I went in and did that, and I had regular points at which I used Google and Google surveys to get the students to feed back to me on my teaching and what I'd done and how they think I could have improved that, and also to find out what they knew. And I was using technology in that way to actually pull in the data and then act on that data in a smarter way. So, I mean, it doesn't worry me. So long as people act on the data, so long as it's not an end in itself or it's a political tool with which you can actually sort of brag about having done this, that or the other within certain parameters, this is as a numbers game. So long as it's sort of built in and people are smart enough to be able to use it to further how people learn, then I don't have a problem with that. So you know, but if it just is an end in itself, and the, let's say, the culture of testing then bars you from having any innovation within the classroom, then you have a problem, because it ossifies over time.
So I mean, I think what you're talking about is what we would call formative assessment here and many other places, as opposed to summative assessment.
Well, yeah, you can have both. And let's take a neutral area like multiple choice and hinge questions. Now, there are a number of smart free apps coming out. I forget what they are, that, you know, will help you devise and pull in responses to hinge questions, so you know whether a student knows this or not, so they have insight into something properly. Smart forensic ways of doing that, you know, and that was built, some of those were built by teachers, you know, in that sense. But it's the same old thing. You've got this massive, you know, thing of Chinese whispers, where a government directive is then sort of mutates through something that senior management think Ofsted might want. And it becomes a culture of must do, as opposed to let's reflect on. And that sort of lacuna, if you want, in terms of rolling out how you do things, is a big problem, I think, in schools at the moment. And you know, I think sometimes people need to tell stories to counter that, to reassure people, say, sit down around the fireside and we'll tell you a story.
Well, again, that sort of speaks to, like, somebody once said, how do you tell if a child knows something? Well, you have a conversation with them.
Yes.
You know, it's maybe more labour intensive, but possibly more useful than...
Yes, it's slowing down. So, I mean, if people, you know, if certain there are tests, the testing culture, that's an opportunity to slow down and to reflect on. But you need the reflecting part, because it's not good enough just to sort of start pushing data out and then have all the pressures of data and all the sort of barnacles, if you want. We want to talk about barnacles. accruing on the back of senior management. And, you know, then you're sort of lumbering around with all this sort of weight of, you know, responsibility and accountability, if you want, that starts to get in the way, and then that's sort of pushed down through the school system, and people, you know, can agree with that or not, and then you have a problem. And at the moment, where it's a buyer's market with teachers, a lot of people are walking or not going in, wouldn't it be nice to be able to create sort of some pathways where there's some sanity, I think.
And I guess that sort of takes us on a nice loop back to your lightweight kit for journalism. As in, you know, you need to be fairly flexible and agile. You can't be weighed down by large cameras and production teams.
No. I mean, that is the true revolution in the last sort of 18 months, I think, where things are becoming so much easier to catalogue. Again, people don't want to go there because there are social minefields associated with media. Mm. So, again, to be able to step back and think about the sort of ethical and the other things that come with the responsibility and the ease of which you are able to do that is another thing as well. Like everything else, you know, there's a cost. And some people say, well, there's this sort of thing that's trotted out now from economics, an opportunity cost. So if you try and make it as easy as possible within a good infrastructure, in terms of something that corresponds well with the school culture, then that opportunity cost is going to be, if people want to talk about opportunity cost, a lesser opportunity cost than something equivalent that may take much, much longer to put into place. For example, schools are on the whole locked down in terms of what you can do. Mm. I can't, when I go to a school and try and do a live stream, I always have a long negotiation beforehand with the IT department and all that. Now I've got a 4G modem. If there is a 4G signal, that's the other thing, around the country to where I'm going, I can circumnavigate that. I don't have to worry about that whole thing. But again, I do need to put certain parameters in place, social ones, in terms of what people do. So, you know, it's how focused, how forensic can you be with the tools that you use? Because they're just tools.
Mm-hmm. And just maybe a last thing, because I think I've said to you I would keep you half an hour, and we've obviously ran past that, but... That what you're actually doing, I think, is saying that you replace the school IT network protection that's automatically built in with a bit of a moral compass and a bit of a thought.
Definitely, and also, I mean, the point is that this, now that sort of IT has been sort of kind of lasered out of the curriculum in terms of academic GCSEs and A-levels and things. It's becoming more of a vocational pathway, which the government is trying to push people down to. That digital awareness is as important as anything. I think I saw a young girl on YouTube sort of bemoaning the fact that she had the perfect lifestyle on Instagram and she had loads of people, you know, following her and all this, and she realized, as do a lot of people, let's say in pop groups and other things, how vacuous something like that is unless you are someone who's very grounded and who has got the life experience. It's that kind of awareness of media and how it interfaces, a terrible word, how it fits or overlaps with your own life and the authenticity of what you do and the relationships you make with the people around you and how that fits into how it's mediated and pushed out. And that is quite an important area which not many people really still don't understand. And so then you get conflicts about over mobile phones and other things. And, it's a whole area that really isn't discussed or understood.
Well, let's hope it becomes a teaching opportunity, I think, because that's, to my eyes, where that should be. It should be seen as not something to push away and leave children to go on with by themselves, but something to take
Very much direction is needed, yeah.
And just the opportunity to discuss it in a safe-ish place is probably a great idea. So, Leon, you said earlier, and I must say, I always just Google L for learning when I'm looking, but it's L for, the numeral 4, L.co.uk.
That's right. That's the one.
and that's the sort of hub of your activities. And we've said you're at iBeans on Twitter. And I guess we should sort of wrap this up, and I don't know if there's anything else you want to say. Or
I'd just say that if you're looking for content that I produce, it's hashtag, again, L4L_news, or L4L news, and that will bring you to specific things that are current in any 1 week in terms of video or audio content as well.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend it. As I say, the recent stuff about equipment has certainly been very useful to me, and I know other people, and some of the interviews that you've got are in my backlog of things to listen to pretty soon. There's some great stuff there, and I say that particularly that London Sound guy, I would be fascinated to hear. So can I just say, Leon, thanks very much for giving up your time. It's been great talking to you, fascinating, and I think so much to think about. So thank you
for giving me the opportunity, John.
That's brilliant. I'm just going to hang up the broadcast now, so good night, folks.